Leonard Gopnik gazed at me from several thousand miles away. I fought the urge to wipe my eyes. My secretary will be in touch, Miss Clark. Thank you for your time. And then with a nod, his face stilled and the screen went blank, and I was left staring at it, contemplating the fact that I'd blown it yet again. That night on the way home, I decided not to think about the interview. Instead, I repeated Mark's words in my head like a mantra. I ran through the things that Lily had done. The uninvited guests, the theft, the drugs, the endless late nights, the borrowing of my things, and ran them through the prism of my group's counsel. Lily was chaos, disorder, a girl who took and gave nothing in return. She was young and biologically related to Will, but that didn't mean I had to assume total responsibility for her or put up with the turmoil she left in her wake. I felt a little better. I did. I reminded myself of something else Mark had said, that no journey out of grief was straightforward. There would be good days and bad days. Today was just a bad day, a kink in the road to be traversed and survived. I let myself into the flat and dropped my bag, suddenly grateful for the small pleasure of a home that was just as I'd left it. I would allow some time to pass, I told myself, and then I would text her. I would make sure our future visits were structured. I would focus my energies on getting a new job. I would think about myself for a change. I would let myself heal. I had to stop at that point because I was a little worried that I was starting to sound like Tanya Horton Miller. I glanced at the fire escape. Step one would be getting up on that stupid roof. I would climb up there by myself, without having a panic attack, and I would sit there for a full half hour, breathe the air, and stop letting a part of my own home have such a ridiculous hold on my imagination. I took off my uniform and put on shorts, and just for confidence, Will's lightweight cashmere jumper, the one I had taken from his house after he died, comforted by the soft feel of it against my skin. I walked down the corridor and opened the window wide. It was just two short flights of iron steps, and then I would be up there. "Nothing will happen," I said aloud and took a deep breath. My legs felt curiously hollow as I climbed out onto the fire escape, but I told myself firmly that it was just a feeling, the echo of an old anxiety. "I could overcome it, just as I would overcome everything else," I heard Will's voice in my ear. "Come on, Clark, one step at a time." I grasped the rails tightly with both hands and began to make my way up. I didn't look down. I didn't let myself think about what height I was at or how the faint breeze recalled an earlier time gone wrong, or the recurring pain in my hip that never seemed to go away. I thought about Sam, and the fury that invoked made me push on. I didn't have to be the victim, the person to whom things just happened. I told myself these things and made it up the second flight of steps as my legs began to shake. I climbed inelegantly over the low wall, afraid that they would give way under me, and dropped onto the roof on my hands and knees. I felt weak and clammy. I stayed on all fours, my eyes shut, while I let myself absorb the fact that I was on the roof. I had made it. I was in control of my destiny. I would stay there for as long as it took to feel normal. I sat back on my heels, reaching for the solidity of the wall around me, and leaned back, taking a long, deep breath. It felt okay. Nothing was moving. I'd done it. And then I opened my eyes and my breath stopped in my chest. The rooftop was a riot of bloom. The dead pots I had neglected for months were filled with scarlet and purple flowers spilling over the edges like little fountains of colour. Two new planters mushroomed with clouds of tiny blue petals, and a Japanese maple sat in an ornamental pot beside one of the benches, its leaves shivering delicately in the breeze. In the sunny corner by the south wall, two grow bags sat by the water tank, with little red cherry tomatoes dangling from their stalks, and another lay on the asphalt with small frilly green leaves emerging from the centre. I began to walk slowly towards them, breathing in the scent of jasmine, then stopped and sat down, my hands grasping the iron bench. I sank onto a cushion that I recognised from my living room. I stared in disbelief at the little oasis of calm and beauty that had been created from my barren rooftop. I remembered Lily snapping the dead twig from a pot and informing me, in all seriousness, that it was a crime to let your plants die, and her casual observation in Mrs. Traynor's garden. David Austin roses. And then I remembered little unexplained bits of soil in my hallway, and I sank my head into my hands. Chapter 17. I texted Lily twice. The first time was to thank her for what she had done to my rooftop. "It's so gorgeous! I wish you'd told me." A day later, I texted to say I was sorry that things had become so tricky between us, and that if she ever wanted to talk more about Will, I would do my best to answer any questions. I added that I hoped she would go and see Mr. Trainer and the new baby, as I knew, as well as most, that it was important to stay in touch with your family. She didn't reply. I wasn't entirely surprised. For the next 2 days, I found myself returning to the rooftop, like someone worrying a loose tooth. I watered the plants, feeling a creeping residual guilt. I walked around the glowing blooms, imagining her stolen hours up there, how she must have carried bags of compost and terracotta pots up the fire escape in the hours I was at work. But every time I thought back to how we had been together, I still went around in circles. What could I have done? I couldn't make the trainers accept her in the way that she needed to be accepted. I couldn't make her happier. And the one person who might have been able to was gone. There was a motorbike parked outside my block. I locked the car and limped across the road to get a carton of milk after my shift, exhausted. It was spitting and I put my head down against the rain. When I looked up, I saw a familiar uniform standing in the entrance to my block and my heart lurched. I walked back across the road, straight past him, fumbling in my bag for my keys. Why did my fingers always turn into cocktail sausages at moments of stress? Louisa. The keys refused to appear. I rifled through my bag a second time, dropping a comb, bits of tissue, loose change, and cursing. I patted my pockets, trying to work out where they might be. Louisa. Then, with a sickening drop of my stomach, I remembered where they were, in the pocket of the jeans I had changed out of just before leaving for work. Oh, great. Really? You're just going to ignore me? This is how we're doing this. I took a deep breath and turned to him. Straightened my shoulders a little. Sam. He looked tired too, his chin greyed with stubble, probably just off a shift. It was unwise to notice these things. I focused on a point a little left of his shoulder. Can we talk? I'm not sure there's any point. No point. I got the message, okay? I'm not even sure why you're here. I'm here because I've just finished a crappy 16-hour shift. And I dropped Donna off up the road and I thought I might as well try and see you and work out what happened with us, because I sure as hell don't have a clue. Really? Really? We glared at each other. Why had I not seen before how abrasive he was, how unpleasant? I couldn't understand how I'd been so blinded by lust for this man when every part of me now wanted to walk away from him. I made one last futile search for my keys and fought the urge to kick the door. So are you at least going to give me a clue? I'm tired, Louisa, and I don't like playing games. You don't like playing games! The words emerged in a bitter little laugh. He took a breath. Okay, one thing. One thing and I'll go. I just want to know why you won't return my calls. I looked at him in disbelief. Because I'm many things, but I am not a complete idiot. I mean, I must have been. I saw the warning signs and I ignored them, but basically, I haven't returned your calls because you're an utter, utter knob, okay? I stooped to pick up my things that had fallen on the ground, feeling my whole body heat rapidly, as if my internal thermostat had suddenly gone haywire. Oh, you're so good, you know, so bloody good. If it weren't all so sick and pathetic, I'd actually be quite impressed by you. I straightened up, zipping my bag. Look at Sam, the good father. So caring, so intuitive. And yet what's really going on? You're so busy shagging your way through half of London, you don't even notice that your own son is unhappy. My son? Yes, because we actually listen to him, you see. I mean, we're not meant to tell outsiders what goes on in the group, and he won't tell you because he's a teenager. But he's miserable, not just for the loss of his mum, but because you're busy swallowing your own grief by having an entire army of women traipse in and out of your bed. I was shouting now, my words tumbling over each other, my hands waving. I could see Samir and his cousin staring at me through the window of the shop. I didn't care. This might be the last time I ever got to say my piece. And yes, I know I was stupid enough to be one of those women. So for him, And from me, you're a knob. And that's why I don't want to talk to you right now. Or ever, actually. He rubbed at his hair. Are we still talking about Jake? Of course I'm talking about Jake. How many other sons have you got? Jake isn't my son. I stared at him. Jake is my sister's son. Was, he corrected himself. He's my nephew. These words took several seconds to filter into a form I could understand. Sam was gazing at me intently, his brow furrowed as he, too, were trying to keep up. But you pick him up. He lives with you. I pick him up on Mondays because his dad works shifts, and he stays with me sometimes. Yeah, he doesn't live with me. Jake's not your son. I don't have any children that I'm aware of, though the whole Lily thing does make you wonder. I pictured him hugging Jake, mentally rewound half a dozen conversations. But I saw him when we first met, and when you and I were talking, he rolled his eyes like... Sam lowered his head. Oh, God, I said. My hand went to my mouth. Those women. Not mine. We stood there in the middle of the street. Samir was now in the doorway watching. He had been joined by another of his cousins. To our left, everyone at the bus stop turned away when they realised we knew they'd been watching us. Sam nodded at the door behind me. Do you think we could talk about this inside? Yes, yes, so... Oh, no, I can't. I seem to have locked myself out. Spare key? In the flat. He ran a hand over his face and checked his watch. He was clearly drained, weary to the bone. I took a step backwards into the doorway. Look, go home, get some rest. We'll talk tomorrow. I'm sorry. The rain suddenly grew heavy, a summer dump, creating torrents and gutters and flooding the street. Across the road, Samir and his cousins ducked back inside. Sam sighed. He looked up at the skies and then straight at me. Hang on. Sam took a large screwdriver he had borrowed from Samir and followed me up the fire escape. Twice I slipped on the wet metal and his hand reached out to steady me. When it did, something hot and unexpected shot through me. When we reached my floor, he pushed the screwdriver deep into the hall window frame and started to lever upwards. It gave gratifyingly swiftly. There. He wrenched it upwards, supporting it with one hand, and turned to me, motioning me through, his expression faintly disapproving. That was way too easy for a single girl living in this area. You look nothing like a single girl living in this area. I'm serious. I'm fine, Sam. You don't see what I see. I want you to be safe. I tried to smile, but my knees were trembling, my palms slippery on the iron rail. I made to step past him and staggered slightly. You okay? I nodded. He took my arm and half-lifted, half-helped me climb clumsily into my flat. I slumped down on the carpet by the window, waiting to feel normal again. I hadn't slept properly for days and felt half-dead, as if the fury and adrenaline that had sustained me had all leached away. Sam climbed in and closed the window behind him, eyeing the broken lock on top of the sash. The hall was dark, the thrumming of the rain muffled on the roof. As I watched, he rummaged around in his pockets until, among other detritus, he picked out a small nail. He took the screwdriver and used the handle to knock the nail in at an angle to stop anyone from opening it from outside. Then he walked heavily over to where I was sitting and held out a hand. Benefits of being a part-time house builder. There's always a nail somewhere. Come on, he said. If you sit there, you'll never get up. His hair was flattened from the rain, his skin glistening in the hall light. As I let him pull me to my feet, I winced and he saw. Hip, I nodded. He sighed. I wish you'd talk to me. The skin beneath his eyes was mauve with exhaustion. There were two long scratches on the back of his left hand. I wondered what had happened the previous night. He disappeared into the kitchen and I heard running water. When he came back, he was holding two pills in a cup. I shouldn't really be giving you these, but they'll give you a pain-free night. I took them gratefully. He watched me as I swallowed them. Do you ever follow rules? Well, I think they're sensible. He took the cup from me. So, are we good, Louisa Clark? I nodded. He let out a long breath. I'll call you tomorrow. Afterwards, I wasn't sure what made me do it. My hand reached out and took his. I felt his fingers close slowly around mine. Don't go. It's late. and motorbikes are dangerous. I took the screwdriver from his other hand and let it fall onto the carpet. He looked at me for the longest time and slid a hand over his face. I don't think I'm good for much just now. Then I promised not to use you for sexual gratification. I kept my eyes on his, this time. His smile was slow to come, but when it did, everything fell away from me, as if I had been carrying a weight I hadn't known. You never know what will happen when you fall from a great height. He stepped over the screwdriver, and I led him silently towards my bedroom. I lay in the dark in my little flat, my legs slung over the bulk of a sleeping man, his arm pinning me pleasurably beneath it, and gazed at his face. Fatal cardiac arrest, motorbike accident, suicidal teenager and a gang-related stabbing on the Peabody estate. Some shifts are just a bit... Shh, it's okay. Sleep. He had barely managed to get his uniform off. He had stripped to his T-shirt and shorts, kissed me, then closed his eyes and collapsed into a dead slumber. I had wondered whether I should cook him something or tidy the flat so that when he woke I might look like someone who actually had a handle on life. But instead, I undressed to my underwear and slid in next to him. For these few moments, I just wanted to be beside him. My bare skin against his T-shirt, my breath mingling with his. I lay listening to his breathing, marvelling at how someone could be so still. I studied the slight bump on the bridge of his nose, the variation in the shade of the bristles that shadowed his chin, the slight curl at the end of his dark, dark eyelashes. I ran through conversations we had had, putting them through a new filter, one that pitched him as a single man, an affectionate uncle, and I wanted to laugh with the idiocy of it all, and cringe at my mistake. I touched his face twice, lightly, breathing in the scent of his skin, the faint tang of antibacterial soap, the primal sexual hint of male sweat. And the second time I did so, I felt his hand tighten reflexively on my waist. I shifted onto my back and gazed out at the streetlights, feeling for once that I was not an alien in this city. And finally, I found myself drifting. His eyes open on mine. A moment later, he realizes where he is. Hey. A lurch into waking. The peculiar dreamlike state that suffuses the small hours. He is in my bed. His leg against mine. A smile creeping across my face. Hey yourself. What time is it? I swivel to catch the digital readout of my alarm. 4:45? Time settles into order. The world reluctantly into something that makes sense. Outside the sodium-lit dark of the street, the minicabs and night buses rumble past. Up here, it is just him and me in the night and the warm bed and the sound of his breathing. I can't even remember getting here. He looks off to the side, his face faintly lit by the streetlights frowning. I watch as memories of the previous day land softly, a silent mental, oh, right. His head turns, his mouth inches from mine, his breath warm and sweet. I missed you, Louisa Clark. I want to tell him then. I want to tell him that I don't know what I feel. I want him, but I'm frightened to want him. I don't want my happiness to be entirely dependent on somebody else's, to be a hostage to fortunes I cannot control. His eyes are on my face, reading me. Stop thinking, he says. He pulls me to him and I relax. This man spends each day out here on the bridge between life and death. He understands. You think too much. His hand slides down the side of my face. I turn towards him, an involuntary reflex, and put my lips against his palm. Just live, I whisper. He nods, and then he kisses me, long and slow and sweet, until my body arches and I am just need and want and longing. His voice is low in my ear, my name pulling me in. He makes it sound like something precious. The next 3 days were a blurred mass of stolen nights and brief meetings. I missed idealization week in the moving on circle because he turned up at the flat just as I was leaving and we somehow ended up an urgent mess of arms and legs waiting for my egg timer to go off so that he could dress and race to pick up Jake on time. Twice he was waiting for me when I returned from my shift and with his lips on my neck, his big hands on my hips, the indignities of the shamrock and clover were, if not forgotten, swept aside along with last night's empties. I wanted to resist him, but I couldn't. I was giddy, diverted, sleepless. I got cystitis and didn't care. I hummed my way through work, flirted with the businessmen and smiled cheerfully at Richard's complaints. My happiness offended my manager. I could see it in his chewed cheek, the way he sought ever more feeble misdemeanours for which to tell me off. I cared about none of it. I sang in the shower, lay awake, dreaming. I wore my old dresses, my brightly coloured cardigans and satin pumps, and let myself be enclosed in a bubble of happiness, aware that bubbles only ever existed for so long before they popped anyway. "I told Jake," he said. He had half an hour's break and he had stopped outside my flat with lunch before I went off for a late shift. I sat beside him in the front seat of the ambulance. "You told him what?" He had made mozzarella, cherry tomato and basil sandwiches. The tomatoes grown in his garden burst in little explosions of flavour in my mouth. He was appalled at how I ate when I was alone. "That you thought I was his dad?" He laughed more than I'd seen him laugh for months. "You didn't tell him I told you his dad cried after sex, right?" "I knew a man who did that once," said Donna. "But he really sobbed. It got sort of embarrassing. The first time I thought I'd broken his penis." I turned to her, open-mouthed. "It's a thing, really. We've had a couple in the rig, haven't we?" "We have. You'd be amazed at the coital injuries we see." He nodded at my sandwich, which was still on my lap. "I'll tell you when your mouth's empty." Coital injuries. Great, because there aren't enough things in life to worry about. His gaze slid sideways as he bit into his sandwich, so that I blushed. "Trust me, I'd let you know." "Just so we're straight, my old mucker," said Donna, offering up one of her ever-present energy drinks. "I am so totally not going to be your first responder for that one." I liked being in the cab. Sam and Donna had the no-nonsense, wry manner of those who had seen pretty much every human condition, and treated it too. They were funny and dark, and I felt oddly at home, wedged between them, as if my life, with all its strangeness, was actually pretty normal. These were the things I learned in the space of several snatched lunch hours. Almost no men or women over the age of 70 would complain about their pain or their treatment, even if a limb were actually hanging off. Those same elderly men or women would almost always apologise for making a fuss. That the term patient PFO was not scientific terminology, but patient pissed and fell over. Pregnant women rarely gave birth in the back of ambulances. I was quite disappointed by that one. That nobody used the term ambulance driver anymore, especially not ambulance drivers. There would always be a handful of men who would answer when asked to describe how much pain they were in out of 10, with 11. But what came through most when Sam arrived back after a long shift was the bleakness. Solitary pensioners, obese men glued to a television screen too large to try to even get themselves up and down their own stairs. Young mothers who spoke no English, confined to their flats with a million small children, unsure how to call for help when it was needed. And the depressed, the chronically ill, the unloved. Some days, he said, it felt like a virus. You had to scrub the melancholy from your skin along with the scent of antiseptic. And then there were the suicides. The lives ended under trains or in silent bathrooms, their bodies often unnoticed for weeks or months until somebody remarked on the smell or wondered why so-and-so's post was now spilling out of their pigeonhole. "Do you ever get frightened?" He lay, oversized, in my little bath. The water had turned faintly pink with the blood from a patient's gunshot wound that had leaked all over him. I was a little surprised at how swiftly I had got used to having a naked man in the vicinity, especially one who could move by himself. "You can't do this job if you're frightened," he said simply. He had been in the army before he joined the paramedics. It was not an unusual career arc. They like us because we don't scare easy and we've seen it all. Mind you, some of those drunk kids scare me far more than the Taliban ever did. I sat on the loo seat beside him and stared at his body in the discoloured water. Even with his size and strength, I shivered. "Hey," he said, seeing something pass across my face and reached out a hand to me. "It's fine, really. I have a very good nose for trouble." He closed his fingers around mine. "It's not a great job for relationships, though. My last girlfriend couldn't cope with it. The hours, nights, the mess." "The pink bath water?" "Yeah, sorry about that. The showers weren't working at the station. I should really have gone home first." He looked at me in a way that showed me there had been no chance of him going home first. He pulled the plug to let some of the water drain away, then turned on the taps for more. "So who was she, your last girlfriend?" I kept my voice level. "I'm not going to be one of those women." even if he had turned out to be not one of those men. Iona, travel agent. Sweet girl. But you weren't in love with her. Why'd you say that? Nobody ever says sweet girl about someone they were in love with. It's like the whole we'll still be friends thing. It means you didn't feel enough. He was briefly amused. So what would I have said if I had been in love with her? You would have looked very serious and said, Karen, complete nightmare. Or shut down and gone all, I don't want to talk about it. You're probably right. He thought for a bit. If I'm honest, I didn't really want to feel much after my sister died. Being with Ellen for the last few months, helping look after her, kind of knocked me sideways. He glanced at me. Cancer can be a brutal way to go. Jake's dad fell apart. Some people do. So I figured they needed me there. If I'm honest, I probably only held it together myself because we couldn't all go to pieces. We sat in silence for a moment. I couldn't tell if his eyes had gone a bit red from grief or soap. Anyway, so yes, probably not much of a boyfriend back then. So who was yours? He said when he finally turned back to me. Will. Of course. Nobody since. Nobody I want to talk about. I shuddered. Everyone's allowed their own way back, Louisa. Don't beat yourself up about it. His skin was hot and wet, making it hard for me to hold onto his fingers. I released them and he began to wash his hair. I sat and watched him, letting the mood lift, enjoying the bunched muscles in his shoulders, the gleam of his wet skin. I liked the way he washed his hair, vigorously with a kind of matter-of-factness, shaking off the excess water like a dog. Oh, I had a job interview, I said when he finished, for a thing in New York. New York? He raised an eyebrow. I won't get it. Shame. I've always wanted an excuse to go to New York. He slid slowly under the water so that only his mouth remained. It broke into a slow smile. But you'd get to keep the pixie outfit, yes? I felt the mood shift, and for no reason at all, other than that he didn't expect it, I climbed, fully clothed, into the bath and kissed him as he laughed and spluttered. I was suddenly glad of his solidity in a world where it was so easy to fall. I finally made an effort to sort out the flat. On my day off, I bought an armchair and a coffee table and a small framed print which I hung near the television, and those things somehow conspired to suggest someone might actually live there. I bought new bedding and two cushions and hung up all my vintage clothes in the wardrobe so that opening it now revealed a riot of pattern and colour, instead of several pairs of cheap jeans and a too-short lurex dress. I managed to turn my anonymous little flat into something that felt, if not quite like a home, vaguely welcoming. By some beneficence of the shift-scheduling gods, Sam and I both had a day off. 18 uninterrupted hours, in which he did not have to listen to a siren, and I did not have to listen to the sound of panpipes or complaints about dry roasted peanuts. Time spent with Sam, I noted, seemed to go twice as fast as the hours I spent alone. I had pondered the million things we could do together, then dismissed half of them as too couple-y. I wondered whether our spending so much time together was wise. I texted Lily one more time. Lily, please get in touch. I know you're mad at me, but just call. Your garden is looking beautiful. I need you to show me how to look after it. And what to do with the tomato plants, which have got really tall. Is this right? Maybe after we could go out dancing. Kiss. I pressed send and stared at the little screen just as the doorbell rang. Hey. He filled my doorway, holding a toolbox in one hand and a bag of groceries in the other. Oh my God, I said. You're like the ultimate female fantasy. Shelves, he said deadpan. You need shelves. Oh, baby, keep talking. And home-cooked food. That's it, I just came. He laughed and dropped the tools in the hallway and kissed me. And when we finally untangled ourselves, he walked through to the kitchen. I thought we could go to the pictures. You know, one of the greatest benefits to shift working is empty matinees, right? I checked my phone. But nothing with blood in it. I get a bit tired of blood. When I looked up, he was watching me. What, you don't fancy it? Or is that going to stamp all over your plans for Zombie Flesh Eaters 15? What? I frowned and dropped my hand to my side. I can't get hold of Lily. I thought you said she'd gone home. Well, she did, but she won't take my calls. I think she's really upset with me. Her friends stole your stuff. You're allowed to be the one who's upset. He started to pull things out of the bags, lettuces, tomatoes, avocados, eggs, herbs, stacking them neatly in my near-empty fridge. He looked up at me as I texted her again. Come on. She could have dropped the phone, left it in some club, or run out of credit. You know what teenagers are like. Or she's just throwing a massive strop. Sometimes you need to let them work it out of their system. I took his hand and shut the fridge door. I need to show you something. His eyes lit up briefly. Not that, no, you bad man. That will have to wait till later. Sam stood on the rooftop and gazed around him at the flowers. What, and you had no idea? None at all. He sat down heavily on the bench. I sat next to him and we both stared at the little garden. I feel awful, I said. I basically accused her of destroying everything she went near, and all the time she was creating this. He stopped to feel the leaves on the tomato plant, then straightened, shaking his head. Okay, so we'll go talk to her. Really? Yeah. Lunch first, then cinema, then we'll turn up on her doorstep. That way she won't be able to avoid you. He took my hand and raised it to his lips. Hey, don't look so worried. The garden is good news. It shows that her head's not in a totally bad place. He released my hand and I squinted at him. How come you always make everything better? I just don't like seeing you sad. I couldn't tell him that I wasn't sad when I was with him. I couldn't tell him that he made me so happy I was afraid of it. I thought of how I liked having his food in my fridge, how I glanced at my phone 20 times a day waiting for his messages, how I conjured his naked body in my imagination in the quiet minutes at work, and then had to think very hard about floor polish or till receipts just to stop myself glowing. Slow down, said a warning voice. Don't get too close. His eyes softened. You have a sweet smile, Louisa Clark. It's one of the several hundred things I like about you. I let myself gaze back at him for a minute. This man, I thought. And then I slapped my hands heavily on my knees. Come on, I said briskly. Let's go watch a movie. The cinema was almost empty. We sat side by side at the back in a seat where someone had knocked out the armrest, and Sam fed me popcorn from a cardboard bucket the size of a dustbin, and I tried not to think about the weight of his hand resting on my bare leg, because when I did, I frequently lost track of what was happening with the plot. The film was an American comedy about two mismatched cops who find themselves mistaken for criminals. It wasn't funny, but I laughed anyway. Sam's fingers appeared in front of me bearing a bulbous knobble of salted popcorn, and I took it, and another, then, as an afterthought, kept hold of his fingers between my teeth. He looked at me and shook his head slowly. I finished the popcorn and swallowed. Nobody will see, I whispered. He raised an eyebrow. I'm too old for this, he murmured. But when I turned his face to mine in the hot, dark air and started to kiss him, he dropped the popcorn and his hand slid slowly up my back. And then my phone rang. There was a hiss of disapproval from the two people at the front. Sorry, sorry, you two. Given there were only four of us in the cinema, I scrambled off Sam's lap and answered, a number I didn't recognize. Louisa? It took me a second to register her voice. Just give me a minute. I pulled a face at Sam and made my way out. Sorry, Mrs. Trainer, I just had to... Are you still there? Hello? The foyer was empty. The cordoned-off queue areas deserted. The frozen drinks machine churning its coloured ice listlessly behind the counter. Oh, thank goodness. Louisa, I wondered if I could speak to Lily. I stood with a phone pressed to my ear. I've been thinking about what happened the other week, and I'm so sorry. I must have seemed... She hesitated. Look, I was wondering if you thought she would agree to see me. Mrs. Trainer, I'd like to explain to her. For the last year or so, I've not been myself. I've been on these tablets, and they make me rather dim-witted. And I was so taken aback to find you on my doorstep, and then I simply couldn't believe what you both were telling me. It all seemed so unlikely, but I've spoken to Stephen, and he confirmed the whole thing, and I've been sitting here for days and digesting it all, and I just think... Will had a daughter. I have a granddaughter. I keep saying the words, and sometimes I think I dreamed it. I listened to the uncharacteristic flurry of her words. I know, I said. I felt like that too. I can't stop thinking about her. I do so want to meet her properly. Do you think she'd agree to see me again? Mrs. Trainer, she's not staying with me anymore. But yes. I ran my fingers through my hair. Yes, of course, I'll ask her. I couldn't focus on the rest of the film. In the end, perhaps realizing that I was simply staring at a moving screen, Sam suggested we leave. We stood in the car park by his bike, and I told him what she'd said. "There, you see," he said, as if I had done something to be proud of. "Let's go." He waited on the bike across the road as I knocked on the door. I lifted my chin, determined that this time I would not let Tanya Horton Miller intimidate me. I glanced back and Sam nodded encouragingly. The door opened. Tanya was dressed in a chocolate linen dress and Grecian sandals. She looked me up and down as she had when we'd first met, as if my own wardrobe had failed some invisible test. This was a little annoying, as I was wearing my favourite check cotton pinafore dress. Her smile stayed on her lips for just a nanosecond, then fell away.
"Louisa!"
"I'm sorry to turn up unannounced, Mrs. Horton Miller.
Has something happened?"
I blinked. "Well, yes, actually." I pushed my hair from the side of my face. "I've had a call from Mrs. Traynor, Will's mother. I'm sorry to bother you with this, but she'd really like to get in contact with Lily, and as she's not picking up her phone, I wondered if you'd mind asking her to call me." Tanya gazed at me from under perfectly plucked brows. I kept my face neutral. "Or maybe we could have a quick chat with her?" There was a short silence.
"Why would you think I would ask her?"
I took a breath, picking my words carefully. "I know you have strong feelings about the Traynor family, but I think it would be in Lily's interests. I don't know if she told you, but they had a rather difficult first meeting the other week, and Mrs. Traynor would really like the chance to start again."
"She can do what she wants, Louisa, but I don't know why you're expecting me to get involved."
I tried to keep my voice polite. Because you're her mother?"
"Whom she hasn't bothered to contact in more than a week."
I stood very still. Something cold and hard settled in my stomach. "What did you say?"
"Lily hasn't bothered to contact me. I thought at least she might come and say hello after we got back from holiday, but no, that's plainly beyond her. Suiting herself as usual."
She extended a hand to examine her fingernails. "Mrs. Horton Miller, she was meant to be with you."
"What?"
"Lily was moving back in with you.
When you got home from your holiday."
"She left my flat 10 days ago." Chapter 18. We stood in Tanya Horton Miller's immaculate kitchen, and I stared at her shiny coffee machine with 108 knobs, which had probably cost more than my car, and ran through the previous week's events for the umpteenth time. It was around 12:30. I gave her £20 for a taxi and asked her to leave her key. I just assumed she'd come home. I felt sick. I walked the length of the breakfast bar and back again, my brain racing. I should have checked. But she tended to come and go as she pleased, and we'd had a bit of a row. Sam stood by the door rubbing his brow, and neither of you has heard anything from her since. "I texted her 4 or 5 times," I said. "I just assumed she was still angry with me." Tanya hadn't offered us coffee. She strolled to the stairwell, peered upstairs, then glanced at her watch, as if she were waiting for us to go. She did not look like a parent who had just discovered her child was missing. Periodically, I heard the dull roar of a vacuum cleaner. "Mrs. Horton Miller, has anyone here heard from her at all? Can you tell from your phone whether she's even read her texts?"
"I told you," she said. Her voice was strangely calm. "I told you this is what she was like, but you wouldn't listen."
"I think we..."
She lifted a hand, stopping Sam. "This is not the first time." "Oh, no. She disappeared for days before, when she was meant to be at boarding school. I blame them, of course. They were meant to know exactly where she was at all times. They only rang us when she'd been gone 48 hours, and then we had to get the police involved. Apparently one of the girls in the dorm had lied for her. Why they couldn't tell who was and who wasn't there is completely beyond me, especially given the ridiculous fees we pay. Francis was all for suing them. He was called out of his annual board meeting to deal with it. It was a huge embarrassment."
Upstairs there was a crash and somebody started to cry. Tanya walked towards the kitchen door.
"Lena, take them out to the park, for goodness sake!"
She came back into the kitchen. "You know she gets drunk. She takes drugs. She stole my Mappin and Webb diamond earrings. She won't admit it, but she did. They were worth thousands.
I have no idea what she did with them. She's taken a digital camera, too."
I thought back to my missing jewellery and something in me tightened uncomfortably.
"So, yes, this is all rather predictable. I did tell you. And now if you'll excuse me, I really have to go and sort the boys out. They're having a difficult day.
But you'll call the police, yes? She's 16 years old and it's been almost 10 days.
Oh, they won't be interested. Not once they know who it is.
Tanya held up a slender finger.
Expelled from 2 schools for truanting, caution for possession of a Class A drug, drunk and disorderly, shoplifting. What's the phrase? My daughter has form. To be perfectly frank, even if the police do find her and bring her back here, she'll simply up and go again when it suits her.
A wire had tightened across my chest, constricting my breath. Where would she have gone? Was that boy, the one who hung around outside my flat, involved? The nightclubbers who had been with Lily that drunken night. How had I been so distracted? Let's call them regardless. She's still very young.
No, I don't want the police involved. Francis is having a very tricky time at work right now. He's fighting to retain his place on the board. If they get wind that he's involved in some sort of police business, that will be it.
Sam's jaw tightened. He took a moment before he spoke. Miss Horton Miller, your daughter is vulnerable. I really think it's time to get someone else involved.
If you call them, I'll simply explain to them what I've just told you.
Mrs. Horton Miller? How many times have you met her, Mr. Fielding? She leaned back against the cooker.
You know her better than I do, do you? You've been kept up nights waiting for her to come home. You've lost sleep. Had to explain her behaviour to teachers and police officers. Apologise to shop assistants for things she's stolen. Bail out her credit card.
Some of the most chaotic kids are those most at risk. My daughter is a talented manipulator. She will be with one of her friends, just as she has been before. I will guarantee that within the next day or two, Lily will turn up here, drunk and screeching in the middle of the night, or knocking at Louisa's door, or begging for money, and you will probably have reason to wish she never had. Someone will let her in, and she'll be sorry and contrite and terribly sad. And then a few days later, she'll bring a bunch of friends home or steal something. And the whole sorry cycle will revolve again.
She pushed her golden hair back from her face. She and Sam stared at each other. I've had to undergo counselling to cope with the chaos my daughter has brought into my life, Mr. Fielding. It's hard enough coping with her brothers and their behavioural difficulties. But one of the things you learn in therapy is that there comes a point when you have to take care of yourself. Lily is old enough to make her own decisions.
She's a child, I said.
Oh, yes, that's right. A child you turned out of your apartment sometime after midnight.
Tanya Horton Miller held my glaze with the complacency of someone who had just been proven right.
Not everything is black and white, much as we would like it to be.
You're not even worried, are you? I said.
She held my gaze. No, frankly. I've been here too many times before.
I made to speak again, but she was ahead of me.
Quite the saviour complex, haven't you, Louisa? Well, my daughter doesn't need saving, and if she did, I wouldn't be hugely convinced by your record so far.
Sam's arm was around me even before I was able to take a breath. My retort formed toxic in my mouth, but she had already turned away. Come on, he said, propelling me out into the hallway. Let's go. We drove around the West End for several hours, slowing to peer at the groups of catcalling, staggering girls, and, more soberly, at the rough sleepers. Then parked up and walked side by side along the dark archways under bridges. We put our heads around the doors of nightclubs, asking if anyone had seen the girl in the photographs on my mobile phone. We went to the club where she had taken me dancing, and to a couple more that Sam said were notorious haunts for underage drinkers. We passed bus stops and fast food joints, and the further we went, the more I thought how ridiculous it was trying to find her among the thousands milling around the humming streets of central London. She could have been anywhere. She seemed to be everywhere. I texted her again, twice, to tell her we were urgently looking for her. And when we got back to my flat, Sam rang various hospitals just to be sure she hadn't been admitted. Finally, we sat on my little sofa and ate some toast. He made me a cup of tea and we sat in silence for a bit. I feel like the worst parent in the world, and I'm not even a parent. He leaned forward, his elbows on his knees. You can't blame yourself.
Yes, I can. What kind of person turfs a 16-year-old out of their flat in the small hours without checking where she's actually going?
I closed my eyes.
I mean, just because she's disappeared before doesn't mean she'll be okay now, does it? She'll be like one of those teenage runaways who disappear and nobody ever hears of them again until some dog out walking digs up their bones in the woods.
Louisa.
I should have been stronger. I should have understood her better. I should have thought harder about how young she is. Was. Oh, God. If something's happened, I'll never forgive myself. And out there right now, some innocent dog walker has no idea that he's about to have his life ruined. Louisa.
Sam put his hand on my leg. Stop. You're going round in circles.
Irritating as she is, it's entirely possible Tanya Horton Miller's right, and Lily will coast in or ring your bell in about 3 hours' time, and we'll all feel like fools and forget what happened until it all starts again.
But why won't she answer her phone? She must know I'm worried.
Perhaps that's why she's ignoring you. He gave me a wry look. She may be enjoying making you sweat a little.
Look, there's not much more we can do tonight, and I've got to go. I have an early shift.
He cleared away the plates and put them in the sink, leaning back against the kitchen cabinets.
Sorry, I said. Not exactly the most fun start to a relationship.
He lowered his chin.
This is a relationship now.
I felt myself colour. Well, I didn't mean...
I'm kidding. He reached out a hand and pulled me to him.
I quite enjoy your determined attempts to convince me you're basically just using me for sex.
He smelt good. Even when he smelled faintly of antiseptic, he smelt good. He kissed the top of my head.
We'll find her, he said as he left.
After he'd gone, I climbed up onto the roof. I sat in the dark, inhaling the scent of the jasmine she trained up the edge of the water tank, and ran my hand softly over the tiny purple heads of the abrisia that tumbled over the terracotta planters. I looked over the parapet, scanned the winking streets of the city, and my legs didn't even tremble. I texted her again, then got ready for bed, feeling the silence of the flat close in around me. I checked my phone for the millionth time, and then my email just in case. Nothing. But there was one from Nathan.
Congratulations! Old man Gopnik told me this morning he's going to offer you the job. See you in NY, mate.
Chapter 19 Lily. Peter is waiting again. Out of the window, she sees him standing against his car. He spots her, gestures up and mouths, "You owe me." Lily opens the window, glances across the road to where Samir is putting out a fresh box of oranges.
"Leave me alone, Peter."
"You know what'll happen."
"I've given you enough. Just leave me alone, okay?"
"Bad move, Lily." He raises an eyebrow. He waits just long enough for her to feel uncomfortable. Lou will be home in half an hour. He hangs around so often she's pretty sure he knows this. Eventually, he climbs back into his car and pulls out onto the main road without looking. As he drives off, he holds his phone out of the driver's window. A message. "Bad move, Lily." Spin the bottle. Such an innocent-sounding game. It had been her and four girls from her school, and they had come up to London on an exeat. They had stolen lipsticks from Boots and bought two short skirts in Topshop, and got into nightclubs for free because they were young and cute, and doormen didn't ask too many questions if there were four of you, and you were young and cute. And inside, over rum and cokes, they had met Peter and his friends. They had ended up in someone's flat in Marylebone at 2 a.m. She couldn't entirely remember how they had got there. Everyone was sitting in a circle, smoking and drinking. She had said yes to everything that was offered her. Rihanna on the music system, a blue beanbag that smelt of Febreze. Nicole had been ill in the bathroom, the idiot. Time had slipped. 2:30, 3:17, 4. She lost track. Then someone had suggested truth or dare. The bottle spun, careered into an ashtray, tipping butts and ash onto the carpet. Someone's truth, the girl she didn't know. On holiday, the previous year, she had engaged in phone sex with her ex-boyfriend while her grandmother slept in the twin bed beside her. The others reeled in fake horror. Lily had laughed.
"Niche," said someone.
Peter had watched her the whole time. She had been flattered at first. He was the best-looking boy there by miles. A man, even. When he looked at her, she refused to drop her eye. She wasn't going to be like the other girls.
"Spin!"
She had shrugged when it pointed to her.
"Dare,"
she had said.
"Always dare."
"Lily never says no to anything," said Mima. Now she wondered whether there was something in the way she had looked at Peter when she said it.
"Okay, you know what that means."
"Seriously?
You can't do that."
Pippa was holding her hands to her face in the way she did when she was being dramatic. Truth, then.
Nah, I hate truth.
So what?
She knew these boys would be chicken. She stood nonchalantly.
Where?
Here.
Oh, my God, Lily!
Spin the bottle, said one of the boys. It hadn't occurred to her to be nervous. She was a bit woozy, and anyway, she quite liked standing there, unbothered, while the other girls clapped and squealed and acted like idiots. They were such fakes. The same girls who would whack anyone on the hockey pitch and talk about politics and what careers in law and marine biology they were aiming for became stupid and giggly and girly in the presence of boys, flicking their hair and doing their lipstick like they had spontaneously filleted out the interesting parts of themselves.
Peter.
Oh my God, Pete, mate, it's you. The boys all catcalling and crowing to hide their disappointment or perhaps relief that it wasn't them. Peter climbing to his feet, his narrow cat's eyes meeting hers. Different from the others. His accent spoke of somewhere tougher.
Here.
She shrugged.
I don't mind.
Next door. He gestured towards the bedroom. She stepped neatly over the girl's legs as they walked through to the next room. One of the girls grabbed at her ankle, telling her not to, and she shook her off. She walked with a faint swagger, feeling their eyes on her as she left. Dare. Always dare. Peter closed the door behind him, and she glanced around her. The bed was rumpled, a horrid patterned duvet that you could tell from 5 yards hadn't been washed in ages, and left a faint, musty trace in the atmosphere. There was a pile of dirty laundry in the corner, a full ashtray by the bed. The room fell silent, the voices outside temporarily stilled. She lifted her chin, pushed her hair back from her face.
"You really want to do this?" she said.
He smiled then, a slow, mocking smile.
"I knew you'd back out."
"Who says I'm backing out?" But she didn't want to do it. She didn't see his handsome features anymore, just the cold glitter in his eyes, the unpleasant twist to his mouth. He put his hands on his zipper. They stood there for a minute.
"It's fine if you don't want to do it. We'll go outside and say you're chicken."
"I never said I wouldn't do it."
"So what are you saying?"
She can't think. A low buzzing has started in the back of her head. She wishes she hadn't come in here. He stifles a theatrical yawn.
"Getting bored, Lily."
A frantic knocking on the door, Jemima's voice.
"Lily, you don't have to do it, okay? Come on, we can go home now."
"You don't have to do it, Lily."
His voice is an imitation, mocking. A calculation. What's the worst that will happen? 2 minutes at worst? 2 minutes out of her life. She will not be a chicken. She will show him. She will show them all. He is holding a bottle of Jack Daniels loosely in one hand. She takes it from him, opens it and swigs from it twice, her eyes locked on his. Then she hands it back and reaches for his belt.
"Pictures or it didn't happen!"
She hears the boys catcalling through the thumping in her ears, through the pain in her scalp as he grips her hair too tight. It is too late by then, way too late. She hears the camera phone click just as she looks up. One pair of earrings, £50 in cash. 100. Weeks later and the demands keep coming. He sends her texts. "I wonder what would happen if I put this on Facebook." She wants to cry when she sees the picture. He sends it to her again and again. Her face, her eyes bloodshot, smudged with mascara. That thing in her mouth. When Louisa comes home, she has to stuff the phone under the sofa cushions. It has become radioactive, a toxic thing that she has to keep close. "I wonder what your friends would think." The other girls don't talk to her afterwards. They know what she did because Peter flashed the picture to everyone as soon as they walked back into the party, ostentatiously adjusting his zipper long after he had to. She had to pretend she didn't care. The girls stared at her and then looked away, and she had known as soon as their eyes met hers that their tales of BJs and sex with unseen boyfriends had been fiction. They were fakes. They had lied about everything. Nobody thought she was brave. Nobody admired her for not being chicken. She was just Lily, the slag, a girl with a cock in her mouth. It made her stomach go into knots even to think about it. She had swigged more Jack Daniels and told them all to go to hell. "Meet me at McDonald's, Tottenham Court Road." By then her mother had changed the locks to her house. She couldn't take money from her purse anymore. They'd blocked her access to her savings account.
"I haven't got anything else. Do you think I'm a mug, little rich girl?"
Her mother had never liked the Mappin and Webb earrings. Lily had hoped she wouldn't even notice they were gone.
She had made fake cooing faces at fuckface Francis when he gave them to her, but she had muttered afterwards that she really didn't understand why he'd bought her heart-shaped diamonds, when everybody knew they were common, and a pendant shape was far better against her bone structure. Peter had looked at the glittering earrings as if she had handed him small change, then tucked them into his pocket. He had been eating a Big Mac, and there was mayonnaise in the corner of his mouth. She felt nauseous every time she saw him. "Do you want to come and meet my mates?"
"No."
"Want a drink?" She shook her head. "That's it. That's the last thing. Those earrings are worth thousands." He had pulled a face.
"I want cash next time. Proper cash.
I know where you live, Lily.
I know you got it."
She felt as if she would never be free of him. He texted her at odd hours, waking her up, keeping her from sleep. That picture, again and again. She saw it in negative, burned onto her retinas. She stopped going to school. She got drunk with strangers. Went out clubbing long after she really wanted to. Anything not to be alone with her thoughts and the relentless ping of her phone. She had moved to where he couldn't find her, and he had found her, parking his car for hours outside Louisa's flat, a silent message. She even thought a few times about telling Louisa, but what could Louisa do? Half the time she was like a one-woman disaster area herself. So Lily's mouth would open and nothing would come out. Then Louisa would start rattling on about meeting her grandmother or whether she had eaten something and she had realized she was on her own. Sometimes Lily lay awake and thought about what it would have been like if her dad had been there. She could picture him in her head. He would have walked outside, grabbed Peter by his neck, and told him never to come near his little girl again. He would have put his arms around her and told her it was all okay, that she was safe. Except he wouldn't, because he was just an angry quadriplegic who hadn't even wanted to be alive, and he would have looked at the pictures and been disgusted. She couldn't blame him. The last time when she'd had nothing to bring him, he had shouted at her on a pavement behind Carnaby Street, calling her worthless, a whore, a stupid little skank. He had pulled up in his car and she had drunk 2 double whiskies because she was afraid to see him. When he'd started shouting at her and saying she was lying, she had started to cry.
"Louisa's chucked me out. My mum's chucked me out. I don't have anything."
People hurried past, their eyes averted. Nobody stopped. Nobody said anything, because a man shouting at a drunk girl in Soho on a Friday night was nothing out of the ordinary. Peter swore and turned on his heel, as if he was leaving, except she knew he wouldn't. And then the big black car had stopped in the middle of the street and reversed, its white lights glowing. The electric window hummed its way down.
"Lily?"
It took her a few seconds to recognize him. Mr. Garside from her stepfather's business. His boss, his partner. He looked at her and then at Peter.
"Are you all right?"
She glanced at Peter, then nodded. He didn't believe her, she could tell. He had pulled over to the side of the road in front of Peter's car and walked across slowly in his dark suit. He had an air of authority, like nothing was going to faze him. She remembered randomly her mother talking about him having a helicopter. "Do you need a ride home, Lily?" Peter lifted his hand with the phone in it, just an inch, just so she knew. And she opened her mouth and it came out.
"He has a bad picture of me on his phone and he's threatening to show it to everyone and he wants money and I don't have any left and I've given him what I can and I just don't have anything left. Please help me."
Peter's eyes widened. He hadn't expected that, but she didn't care what happened. She just felt desperate and tired and she didn't want to carry all this by herself anymore. Mr. Garside regarded Peter for a moment. Peter stiffened his shoulders and straightened, as if he were considering whether to run for his car.
"Is this true?" Mr. Garside said. "It's not a crime to have pictures of girls on your phone,"
Peter smirked, an act of bravado.
"I'm well aware of that. It is, however, a crime to use them to extort money."
Mr. Garside's voice was low and calm, as if it were perfectly reasonable to be discussing someone's naked pictures in the middle of the street. He moved his hand to his inside pocket.
"So, what will it take to make you go away?"
"What?"
"Your phone. How much do you want for it?"
Lily's breath stopped in her throat. She looked from one man to the other. Peter was staring at him in disbelief.
"I'm offering you cash for the phone, on the basis that this is the only copy of that photograph."
"I'm not selling my phone."
"Then I have to advise you, young man, that I'll be contacting the police and identifying you through your car registration. And I have a lot of friends in the police force. Quite high-up friends."
He smiled a smile that wasn't really a smile at all. Across the road, a bunch of people spilled out of the restaurant, laughing. Peter looked at her and back at Mr. Garside. He lifted his chin.
$5,000.
Mr. Garside reached into his inside pocket. He shook his head.
I don't think so.
He pulled out his wallet and counted out a bundle of notes.
I think this will do. It sounds as though you've already been amply rewarded. The phone, please.
It was as if Peter had been hypnotized. He hesitated for just a moment, then handed Mr. Garside his phone. Just like that. Mr. Garside checked that the SIM was in it, tucked it into his inside pocket, and opened the car door for Lily.
I think it's time for you to leave, Lily.
She climbed in, like an obedient child, hearing the solid thunk of the car door as it closed behind her. And then they were off, gliding smoothly down the narrow street, leaving Peter shell-shocked. She could see him in the wing mirror, as if he too couldn't believe what had just happened.
Are you all right?
Mr. Garside didn't look at her as he spoke. Is that it? He glanced sideways, then back at the road.
I think so, yes.
She couldn't believe it. She couldn't believe the thing that had hung over her for weeks could be fixed just like that. She turned to him, suddenly anxious. Please don't tell my mum and Francis. He frowned slightly.
If that's what you want.
She let out a long, silent breath. Thank you, she said quietly. He patted her knee.
Nasty lad. You need to be careful with your friends, Lily.
He moved his hand back onto the automatic gear stick before she had even registered its presence. He hadn't batted an eyelid when she had told him she had nowhere to stay. He had driven her to a hotel in Bayswater and spoken quietly to the receptionist, who had handed her a room key. She was relieved he hadn't suggested taking her to his house. She didn't want to explain herself to anyone else.
I'll pick you up tomorrow when you're sober, he said, tucking his wallet into his jacket pocket.
She had walked heavily up to room 311, laid down on the bed fully clothed, and slept for 14 hours. He called to say he would meet her for breakfast. She showered, took some clothes out of her rucksack, and ran an iron over them in the hope that she looked a little more presentable. She was not good at ironing. Lena had done that sort of thing. When she came downstairs to the restaurant, he was already sitting there, reading a paper, a half-drunk cup of coffee in front of him. He was older than she remembered, his hair thinning on top, a faint crepiness to the skin of his neck. The last time she had seen him had been at a company event at the races where Francis had drunk too much, and her mother had hissed at him furiously whenever nobody else was about, and Mr. Garside, catching it, had raised his eyebrows at Lily, as if to say, "Parents, eh?" She slid into the chair opposite him, and he lowered his newspaper. "Aha! How are you today?" She felt embarrassed, as if last night she had been overly histrionic, as if it had all been a fuss over nothing.
"Much better, thank you."
"Did you sleep well?"
"Very well, thank you."
He had studied her for a minute over his glasses.
"Very formal."
She smiled. She didn't know what else to do. It was too weird being there with her stepdad's work colleague. The waitress offered her coffee and she drank it. She eyed the breakfast buffet, wondering if she was expected to pay. He seemed to sense her discomfort. "Eat something. Don't worry, it's paid for." He turned back to his paper. She wondered whether he would tell her parents. She wondered what he had done with Peter's phone. She hoped he had slowed his big black car on the Thames embankment, lowered his window, and hurled it into the swirling currents below. She wanted never to see that picture again. She rose and fetched a croissant with some fruit from the buffet. She was starving. He sat reading as she ate. She wondered how they looked from outside, like any father and daughter probably. She wondered whether he had children.
"Do you have to be at work?"
He smiled, accepted more coffee from the waitress. "I told them I had an important meeting." He folded his newspaper neatly and put it down. She shifted uncomfortably in her seat.
"I need to get a job."
"A job?" He sat back.
"Well, what kind of job?"
"I don't know. I kind of messed up my exams."
"And what do your parents think?"
"They don't... Well, I can't... Well, they're not very happy with me right now. I've been staying with friends."
"You can't go back there?"
"Not right now. My friend isn't very happy with me either."
"Oh, Lily," he said, and sighed.
He looked out of the window, considering something for a minute, then glanced at his expensive watch. He thought for another moment, then called his office and told someone he was going to be late back from his meeting. She waited to hear what he had to say next. You finished? He put his newspaper into his briefcase and stood up. Let's go and make a plan. She had not been expecting him to come to the room and was embarrassed by the state of it. The damp towels left on the floor, the television blaring trashy daytime programs. She dumped the worst of it in the bathroom and shoved what was left of her belongings hastily into her rucksack. He pretended not to notice, just gazed out of the window, then turned back when she sat on the chair as if he had only just seen the room. It's not a bad hotel, this, he said. I used to stay here when I couldn't face the drive to Winchester. Is that where you live? It's where my wife lives, yes. My children are long grown up. He put his briefcase on the floor and sat on the edge of the bed. She got up and fetched the complimentary notepad from the bedside table in case she needed to take notes. Her phone let out a chime and she glanced down. Lily, just call me. Louisa, kiss. She shoved it into her back pocket and sat down, the notepad on her lap. So, what do you think? That you're in a tricky position, Lily. You're a bit young to be getting a job, to be frank. I'm not sure who would hire you. I'm good at stuff, though. I'm a hard worker, and I can garden. Garden. Well, perhaps you could get work gardening. Whether that's going to bring in enough for you to support yourself is another matter. Have you got any references? Any holiday jobs? No. My parents always gave me an allowance. He tapped his hands on his knees. You've had a difficult relationship with your father, haven't you? Francis isn't my real father. Yes, I'm aware of that. I know you left home some weeks ago. It all seems like a very sad situation. Very sad. You must feel rather isolated. She felt the lump swell in her throat and thought for a moment that he was reaching for a handkerchief. But it was then that he reached into his jacket pocket and pulled out a phone. Peter's phone. He tapped it once, twice, and she saw a flash of her own image. Her breathing stalled in her chest. He clicked on it, making it bigger. Her cheeks flooded with colour. He stared at the photograph for what felt like several years. You really have been quite a bad girl, haven't you? Lily's fingers closed in a fist around the hotel bedspread. She looked up at Mr. Garside, her cheeks burning. His eyes didn't leave the picture. A very bad girl. Eventually he looked up at her, his gaze even, his voice soft. I suppose the first thing we need to do is work out how you can repay me for the phone and the hotel room. But, she began, you didn't say... Oh, come on, Lily. A live wire like you. You must know that nothing comes for free. He looked down at the image. You must have worked that out a while ago. You're obviously good at it. Lily's breakfast rose into her throat. You see, I could be very helpful to you. Give you somewhere to stay until you're back on your feet. A little leg up the career ladder. You wouldn't need to do very much in return. Quid pro quo. You know that phrase. You did Latin at your school, didn't you? She stood abruptly and reached for her rucksack. His hand shot out and took hold of her arm. With his free hand, he tucked the phone slowly back into his pocket. Let's not be hasty about this, Lily. We wouldn't want me to have to show this little picture to your parents, would we? Goodness knows what they would think about what you've been up to. Her words stuck in her throat. He patted the bedspread beside him. I would think very carefully about your next move. Now, why don't we... Lily's arm flew back, shaking him off, and then she was wrenching the hotel room door open, and she was gone. Feet pumping, racing down the hotel corridor, her bag flying out behind her. London teemed with life into the small hours. She walked while cars nudged night buses impatiently along main roads. Minicabs wove in and out of traffic. Men in suits made their way home or sat in glowing office cubicles halfway to the sky, ignoring the cleaners who worked silently around them. She walked with her head low and her rucksack on her shoulder. And when she ate in late-night burger restaurants, she made sure her hood was up and that she had a free newspaper to pretend to read. There was always someone who would sit down at your table and try to get you to talk. Come on, darling. I'm only being friendly. All the while, she replayed that morning's events in her head. What had she done? What signal had she sent? Was there something about her that meant everyone assumed she was a whore? The words he had used made her want to cry. She felt herself shrink into her hood, hating him, hating herself. She used her student card and rode on underground trains until the atmosphere became drunk and febrile. Then it felt safer to stay above ground. The rest of the time she walked, through the glittering neon lights of Piccadilly, down the lead-dusted length of Marylebone Road, around the pulsing late-night bars of Camden, her stride long, pretending she had somewhere to be, only slowing when her feet began to ache from the unforgiving pavement. When she got too tired, she begged favours. She spent one night at her friend Nina's, but Nina asked too many questions, and the sound of her chatting downstairs to her parents while Lily lay, soaking the grime out of her hair in the bath, made her feel like the loneliest person on earth. She left after breakfast, even though Nina's mum said she was welcome to stay another night, gazing at her with concerned maternal eyes. She spent two nights on the sofa of a girl she had met while clubbing, but there were three men sharing the flat, and she didn't feel relaxed enough to sleep, and sat fully clothed, hugging her knees, watching television, with the sound turned off until dawn. She spent one night at a Salvation Army hostel, listening to two girls argue in the next-door cubicle, her bag clutched to her chest under the blanket. They said she could have a shower, but she didn't like to leave her bag in the lockers while she got wet. She drank the free soup and left. But mostly she walked, spending the last of her cash on cheap coffee and Egg McMuffins, and growing more and more tired and hungry, until it was hard to think straight, hard to react quickly when the men in doorways said disgusting things, or the staff in the cafe told her that she'd made that one cup of tea last long enough, young lady, and it was time to move on. And all the while she wondered what her parents were saying at that moment, and what Mr. Garside would say about her when he showed them the pictures. She could see her mother's shocked face, Francis's slow shake of the head, as if this new Lily was of no surprise to him whatsoever. She had been so stupid. She should have stolen the phone. She should have stamped on it. She should have stamped on him. She shouldn't have gone to that boy's stupid flat and behaved like a stupid idiot and broken her own stupid life. And that was usually the point at which she would start crying again and pull her hood further up around her face and... Chapter 20. She's what? In Mrs. Traynor's silence, I heard disbelief, and perhaps, maybe I was being oversensitive, a faint echo of the last thing of hers I had failed to keep safe. And you've tried to call? She's not picking up. And she hasn't been in touch with her parents? I closed my eyes. I had been dreading this conversation. She's done this before, apparently. Mrs. Horton Miller is convinced Lily will turn up any minute. Mrs. Traynor digested this. But you aren't. Something's not right, Mrs. Traynor. I know I'm not a parent, but I just... My words trailed away. Anyway, I'd rather be doing something than nothing, so I'm going to get back out walking the streets to find her. I just wanted you to know the truth about what was going on. Mrs. Traynor was silent for a moment, and then she said, her voice measured but oddly determined, Louisa, before you go, would you mind giving me Mrs. Horton Miller's telephone number? I called in sick, noting fleetingly that Richard Percival's cold, I see, was actually more ominous than his previous blustering protests. I printed off photographs, one of Lily's Facebook profile photographs, and one of the selfies she'd taken of the two of us. I spent the morning driving around central London. I parked on curbs, leaving the hazard lights flashing as I nipped into pubs, fast food joints, nightclubs where the cleaners, working in the stale, dim air, peered up at me with suspicious eyes. Have you seen this girl? Who wants to know? Have you seen this girl? Are you police? I don't want no trouble. Some people evidently thought it was amusing to string me along for a bit. Oh, that girl! Brown hair! Yeah. What was her name? Nah, never seen her before. Nobody seemed to have seen her. And the further I travelled, the more hopeless it felt. What better place to disappear than London? A teeming metropolis where you could slide into a million doorways, mingle with crowds that never ended. I would gaze up at the tower blocks and wonder whether even now she was lying on someone's sofa in her pyjamas. Lily picked up people with ease and had no fear of asking for anything. She could be with anyone. And yet...